Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. On today's episode, I had the pleasure to speak with Miss Kara Golding. Kara is the CEO of Hint. Hint is a lifestyle brand that she has created out of San Francisco, and really it's focused initially on healthy soft drinks. She wanted to take on the big brands. Then she's kind of moved on to sunscreen. And so listen, Kara is wise. Previously she was at AOL, and she's just a rock star. So today on Executive After Hours, for the final episode of 2017, Kara Golding, CEO of Hint. It's a lifestyle brand that you should check out. Over December, as I said in the previous podcast opening somewhere, I'm going to be doing and producing the 10-part series that I did for the University of Western Australia around diversity inclusion, where I actually interviewed some of their best alumni, and they have a historic alumni base globally, around this concept of inclusion diversity. These are all like 15, 20-minute episodes, short and sharp, but these will be produced over December. So stay tuned to that for the remainder of the month. And then I'm back on with live episodes back in January, the first week of January. And then I'm hitting the home stretch of my book, right? So just got proofs for some concepts. That isn't really proofs, I guess, but concepts for the cover. So we're getting closer there as well. And hopefully I get that wrapped up before the first of the year, so I can start my official mass marketing campaign to annoy the bejesus out of all of you guys out there around the book. Right now I'm sending the book out to potential individuals to write the foreword. So once I find that out, I'll make that announcement. I'm super excited about some of the people I've approached. So I just need one to say yes, right? It's just that I just need one, just one person. And last night I had so much fun. I went to a FIFA game out here in the Middle East. It was for the FIFA Club Championship Series. So it was one of the earlier rounds with a local team here in the UAE and a team from Auckland, New Zealand. Unfortunately, the team from Auckland, New Zealand lost. So they'll be turning around, getting on an airplane, and flying back the 15 to 25 hours that it will take them to get to their home country. All right, so listen, everyone, have an awesome holiday season. Have a fantastic New Year's. And enjoy, reflect, and be grateful for 2017 before we move on to 2018. In 2018, be aware, listen for me and my book that's coming out. It is getting just tremendous reviews. That sounded very Donald Trump-esque, so I apologize. But it is getting good reviews from all sorts of different people I've sent it out for us for review, essentially. And the feedback's always the same. Stories are great. Insight is great. I have some, you know, I talk about my personal journey, which is fairly vulnerable, if you will. And so I'm really, really excited about this book and my first foray into it. And, you know, I'm not sure how to say it any other way, but you're just going to need to check it out. I'll try to leak some of the aspects of it out. Right now it's line editing, so they'll sharpen it up, fix some of the prose, which is normal, repeated words, blah, blah, blah. So thank you guys so much for an awesome year. The podcast is jumping back up again. I had a little bit of a lull, but that's, you know, hopefully a testament to what I'm doing. And I'd love to hear from you guys. I'd love to get some more reviews on iTunes. I'm so close to the 100 mark. And I'd really love to, as a Christmas present to me, to have any of you guys who listen who have not gone to iTunes and hit review, please go to iTunes and review. It helps with the rankings. It helps with the promotion of the show. It helps grow the audience. It helps me get larger, better, amazing guests. And now I have amazing guests all the time, but you know where I want to take this particular podcast is actually a bigger brand, right? I want this podcast to actually be part of a bigger picture. And it only happens when I start attracting more people to come on the show, to engage in these real conversations. And so you, my lovely, awesome individuals who listen to this show globally, I can't thank you enough. And thank you for 2017. And as I said, enjoy your time, be grateful, reflect. And I will see you on the flip side. Have a wonderful holiday season. See you. So why don't we just kind of start? I mean, you know, obviously, just to give my audience a 10,000 foot view, you know, I am talking to Kara Golden, CEO of Hint, and mother of health, if you will. And so, Kara, thank you for stopping by Executives After Hours. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you. So, you know, you and I were kind of talking just a second ago, and you're talking about the vanilla, all-white Arizona that you grew up in. And not to be, you know, lack of parlance or words there, but what was it like growing up in Arizona? Did you have a big family, small family? Like, what was it like?
Yeah, so big family, five kids in the family. Parents actually were transplants from Minnesota, and my dad decided he didn't want to shovel snow anymore and made the executive decision that he was going to move us all to Arizona.
Arizona?
So we moved there, Scottsdale.
Okay.
And so we moved there, and I was, you know, really little girl and at the time. Phoenix, Scottsdale area was like 100,000 people when we moved there. It was it was a long time ago. It was 1970. It was just super crazy. It was a great place. I mean, it was super beautiful, very different, geographically versus, you know, Minnesota that had lakes and green and very Midwest culture. I'll never forget, my mom said, my dad actually audio taped her coming when she saw the Phoenix airport, and we were driving back to our new home. And my mom was saying, like, who would want to look at cactuses all day? And I mean, she was just like making fun of the beauty of it. Yeah. And then, you know, within a year, I mean, she just really loved it a lot.
Yeah.
And, I always joke that we were like original settlers there.
Yeah.
Like I said, we had five kids.
So where are you in that pecking order? Like, where are you in that?
The last. The baby. So, yeah.
So, you know, you grew up in this family in the South, right? Southwest, to be clear. And I want to know, like, from an environmental standpoint, you're raised in this Catholic family, how did those morals or values, because were your parents practicing Catholics as well, like pretty strict Catholics?
Yeah, I mean, we went to church every Sunday. Yeah. It was just sort of like, it was just part of a routine.
This is, right? This is totally my wife's family too, by the way. Like, exactly. Five kids, routine.
Yeah.
She's got a brother with six kids, another brother with six kids, a brother with three kids. We've got four kids. Super Catholic family.
Yeah. I mean, it was just sort of, and I never, you know, questioned it. I wasn't this rebellious kid who said, like, oh, I can't go to church. I mean, I enjoyed going to church. I didn't really necessarily know the meaning of it, right?
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
of what I was doing. But I, you know, went every Sunday or sometimes Saturday evening, depending, and, you know, and that's what I did. But my parents weren't like going to church every single day. I mean, they weren't, you know, super religious. But I think my parents were also like, you know, I remember growing up and having friends, for example, that were divorced and they were getting, you know, excommunicated. Mm-hmm. Their parents were getting excommunicated from the church because, you know, you couldn't be divorced at the time. Yeah. And I remember my parents feeling like bad, right? Mm-hmm. Like they weren't, you know, they thought like, well, the kids shouldn't be, you know, they shouldn't have to feel the brunt of that kind of thing. So it wasn't like they were, you know, 1,000% following the line.
Did you feel like it was, it was more like a place to create a moral framework for their kids?
Yeah.
I would imagine, I don't know what it was like. What was it like you being the youngest in a broken, like basically youngest of three, but youngest of five, right? So,
yeah. You know, it's funny because I think if you talk to my brothers and sisters, they always, you know, they always like to say that the youngest is the most spoiled, right? Like, because the parents finally wake up and figure out, like, okay, this is the last shot I've got at being a parent. Yeah. I've got to be, you know, I've got to, like, you know, so
I've got to minimize how I screw my kid up.
Right. Right. And so I never felt that, of course. Like, I always tell my youngest son this, that I was like, your brother and your sisters will always think like you were so spoiled. But, you know, I never really felt like that as a kid. Instead, like, I always wanted to do what they were doing. So mm-hmm. I remember, you know, when my brother, who's 3 years older than me, had a job and I was 13 and he's 16, I'm like, well, he's making money and he can go to the mall and go spend it. And I don't have any money because I'm not working. So then I had to figure out, how do I go get a job? And I actually had my first job, you know, outside of babysitting and doing stuff like that. I had my first job when I was 14 and the woman who was managed, I managed a toy store. I actually became a buyer of a toy store in Scottsdale. At 14. And like, my dad was like, wait, how did you get that job? And I'm like, I just went in and applied. And he's like, wait, she didn't ask you for like how old you were? And I'm like, no. And I mean, it's actually interesting because I think she didn't really want to know the answer because she really needed help. And I was willing to work on Saturdays and Sundays during the day. And so and then I quickly actually she realized that, I mean, I was a kid and I knew exactly what toys would sell in the store and what the trends were. And so she, you know, basically made me the buyer of the store and gave me all the catalogs to go to. I went to trade shows with her.
That's awesome.
And I became, it was crazy. And so, yeah, so.
You're pulling down like 60 grand at 14 going around buying toys.
Hardly. I mean, I wasn't doing it, but I learned, you know, I learned how to work a cash register. Yeah. I was like, you know, buying toys. I was cheap labor. I mean, she was paying me, but I don't know. Maybe I was making 10 bucks an hour. I don't know.
It wasn't awesome
like anything
then.
Crazy. Right. And it was really fun and I enjoyed it. And I, you know, and I basically, like, she asked me, I couldn't work after school cause I had lots of sports and whenever I had, you know, meets or tournaments or whatever, she let me off. So it was,
you realize you had every, you're basically an adult version of the movie, Big with Tom Hanks.
Yeah. Like, yeah, no, it was super fun. And you know, I finally had money and I just sort of did my thing. And then I figured out that I could actually make more money waitressing. And so I worked at a Mexican restaurant.
You know, I'm trying to envision being a dad, obviously, of my four kids and thinking, okay, here's my son at 13 or 14 going working, blah, blah, blah. And then I think waiting tables. Now, I waited tables for college. I think that everybody should wait tables at least one summer in their life to have an appreciation for that job. So what is something that you learned waiting tables that you kind of took forward in your life?
So I was in Arizona and I worked at this restaurant and, it was a Mexican restaurant. And I remember sitting there so we could get a meal before our shift started. And so, you know, I'd always get my quesadilla, nothing super fancy and, you know, my guacamole and sit down. And there were a bunch of workers who, you know, bussed or cooked in the kitchen. And, you know, you're just like, you all work together, right?
Yeah.
And so I start talking to them and learned a little bit of Spanish along the way and whatever. But, you know, it was interesting because some of them I noticed didn't speak as much English as others. And, you know, they would be the new people who came in. And I started to realize that some of these people had immigrated, and, you know, I didn't know anything, right? I'm just like in high school at the time, and they had, you know, some of them probably even illegally immigrated. And so I'd start like talking to them, and then some of their friends would tell me the stories of how they came over, and most of them were men, but some of them were women. And what I realized is that, you know, there were these people that were working, and they were like trying to earn a living and trying to support themselves and their family, and that they had to be afraid if somebody would walk in from immigration and send them back. And I would hear these stories, actually, probably the most haunting story is I would hear these stories about, you know, their journey and how Americans would actually take money from them to get across the border. And oftentimes they would, they called them coyotes, actually. And coyotes were people, have you ever heard about?
Yeah.
These Americans. Yeah. And so the coyotes would take them. And here I am, like a 17-year-old girl, just like with, you know, eyes and ears wide open to sort of what these people experienced. And, you know, and oftentimes it wasn't so great. There was rape. There was, you know, lots of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they'd steal a lot more from them than, you know, it was just, it was
pretty depressing, you know, when you start thinking about
it. And these
it.
Were yeah. Americans.
Yeah. Like, how does that shift your thinking?
So I think it shifted my thinking, and, you know, many, many years later, I think back on it, and I still, you know, I have this, I look at immigrants in a totally different way. I mean, the immigrants that I worked with were, you know, they were not the homeless people on the street, right? They were figuring out a way to actually work and support themselves and support them, their family. And, you know, they were oftentimes living in, you know, horrible situations where there were 40 people living in a one room house in the slums of Phoenix. Right. But they were actually happy and they were okay.
Yeah.
And they showed up for work on time and they, you know, and I thought, I don't know.
Like, isn't that the most amazing thing though? Like, doesn't it put life, even though you don't realize it at 17 in retrospect,
yeah.
it puts life in perspective, right? These people are eating a shit sandwich every day, but they have a smile on their face and you're like, okay.
They have a smile on their face. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. And that's what, and so, you know, years later when, you know, I hear like, get immigrants out of here, you know, it was just, I'm sure that my perspective, you know, is definitely driven by some of those stories. And I remember, you know, I met my husband when I was in New York, and I mean, I would tell him these stories just kind of, you know, just not just randomly, like just about experiences.
Yeah.
And I would hear about this and he'd be just like, you know, he's a New York City kid. He's like, what? Like, how do you know these? How did you know these people? And I'm like, I'm waitressing at this restaurant. And, you know, and then actually years later, what's so crazy is a lot of those people actually got their, you know, they became citizens and they were able to. But, you know, I still look at them and think like, well, I know the experience that they've been through.
Yeah, so what I want to do, because obviously you're being really generous with your time, you know, if we go year by year, we'll be here for another couple of days maybe. So I want to make sure that we get to some other things. So I just have a couple more questions. So you eventually move from New York. How many years were you in New York?
Five.
5 years. And then you moved – that's when you moved out west.
Yeah, so I met my husband in New York and actually, I was at CNN at the time, and my husband wanted to do technology law, and we he interviewed for a bunch of firms in New York, and then everybody was like, "Look, technology law is going to be happening in Silicon Valley before New York," and so I, you know, basically said to him, you know, "Sayonara, you." Like, go on the plane. I mean, I wasn't angry about it. I was just kind of like, okay, he's moving. We had been going out for a few years and we'll do this long distance thing. And then he surprised me by asking me to marry him. And so I moved to San Francisco, quit my job at CNN. And, you know, I could have continued working for CNN, but I really felt like most of the advertising and the stuff that I was doing was happening in New York, and it was the satellite office in San Francisco was pretty small. So I just decided I was going to take some time off to sort of figure out what I was going to do next. And when I moved out to San Francisco, I was actually reading an article in the Wall Street Journal about online shopping. Some friends of mine had worked on some projects around the internet and doing some cable modem projects that were going on primarily in New York, but I heard there were some things going on out in San Francisco. And anyway, I read about this guy, Steve Jobs, who had basically come up with this idea that you had to actually put all the graphics on a disc and then have the consumer stick the disc in the machine, and then your text-driven experience could be much more interesting because all the graphics would actually be sitting on the, you know, disc and ultimately the consumer's computer versus actually going through any type of, you know, any type of baud modem, right? Mm-hmm. And so I just thought, again, it was something that I knew nothing about, but I thought it was really fascinating. And so I picked up the phone and called the guy that was quoted in the article. And it wasn't Steve Jobs. It was a guy that had actually worked for Steve at Apple. And I called him and said, you know, I know you spun out of Apple because Apple wasn't going to continue this project. They were working on some other stuff. And I know you're in the Bay Area. I'd love to just grab coffee with you. And again, like not really asking for a job, but just sort of interested in the topic. And I went down to their office in San Mateo, which is just a little bit south of San Francisco. And it was three guys that had worked at Apple. And
this is AOL, right?
This was a product called To Market that was actually a project that came out of Apple, and AOL had actually agreed to put some funding into this project when these three guys left Apple because Apple wasn't going to fund it anymore. And so Steve Case had actually been working with Steve Jobs on some stuff at Apple that was kind of, you know, around this project, but it was actually still owned by Apple at the time. But anyway, so I'm sitting here in their office and having lunch with these three guys, and you know, had no idea really what AOL was. And Steve Case was down in our office and this other guy, Ted Leonsis. And, you know, it was basically, you know, five guys like sitting around, and they heard about how I had helped write the business plan for this thing called the Airport Channel, which is now CNN in airports. And I'd worked at CNN doing that. And so they were like, okay, well, do you have any other questions about our business? And I'm like, how are you guys going to make money? And I remember, you know, Ted Leonsis looking at these guys that worked at Apple, and he's like, this is the person that you want on your team. I mean, somewhat joking, but somewhat like, okay, how are you guys actually going to make this thing work? And, you know, the reality is that they didn't really know how to get the concept was to get shopping and e-commerce catalogers to put their stuff on a disc. And
that's like an early Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, this was before Amazon. Yeah. It was really, and so this was 94. And so they hired me in to basically run the business development for this project.
So let's talk about it for 5 minutes, and then I'll let you run, obviously.
Yeah.
You started in 2005 with Hint, right? You have this aha mm-hmm. moment of really wanting to transform not only your health, but the health of your kids. You know, I read a Forbes article that was written in 2014 saying you kind of just basically cleared out everything in your house, all the cupboards, the fridge, and you were like, I'm starting from scratch. Because you had realized that all the crap you're putting in your body, all the preservatives, all the chemicals, everything was just basically, it's not healthy. I mean, when you really do the research, most food you eat is pretty unhealthy for you. So this, you know, in our house, the closer to the ground, to the earth, the better, right? The fresher it is. So you start this company in 2005, and in this article in 2014, talks about you earning $30 million, which is amazing in that company, for a company, in any company, but for this particular company. But here's what I think is amazing. So I was doing some more research, and then 3 years later, at least based on the research I did, now your revenues are around $90 million. Is that right?
So we don't. I mean, we're a private company, and we don't talk about the revenues. We've talked about, you know, there's lots of people that are estimating us.
That's fair.
Just shy of 100 million.
So my question is this then: how have you dealt? It's not been quick, but in the last 3 years, it's been exponential growth. So how have you managed to keep control of Hint's brand as you're also expanding to sunscreen and other verticals at the same time? How are you managing to deal with this growth personally as well as from a professional standpoint?
You know, I think it just really goes back to doing something that I not only love and I believe in, but I feel like so many people can benefit from it. I mean, that's a really powerful thing to sort of have on your, you know, backside, to sort of know that you have lots of consumers that are relying on you to actually do something that's going to help them get healthy. And so, you know, I was joking with somebody on Friday about this that I was talking to, that, you know, I still as a founder and, you know, CEO and an entrepreneur, I still read customer service emails and sometimes pop in on customer service phone calls. And, you know, if there's really a problem, I mean, it's not beyond me to actually get on the phone with somebody to really understand what's going on, because I really believe that the customers ultimately, you know, drive this business. And that to me is it's more important to understand how the customers are reacting to your company than to focus on, oh my God, we're growing so much, right? Like, instead, are the customers, do they continue to feel like we're giving them what they want, right? That's the most important thing to me. And then, you know, the numbers are just numbers, right? Mm-hmm. They're just, it's really.
It can all be gone tomorrow, technically, right? So.
Totally. Yeah. Like, and so that's the thing. So I care more about what the customers are saying, and that are we satisfying the customers? And so, you know, people today are asking, we launched a sunscreen in January, and people, especially in the beverage and CPG industry, are like, oh, you know, like, why would you do that? I mean, what, like, why would you, you know, launch a sunscreen versus a beverage company? And I'm, and my whole thing was, first of all, it started with my own problem that trying to find a great sunscreen. And so I decided to use our fruit essences in order to actually create a great, not only feeling sunscreen, but also smelling sunscreen. And, you know, I always say to the people at Coke and Pepsi and executives that I know from there and some of the others, I'm like, listen, I didn't like start a sunscreen for you guys. I started it for the customer. And so, you know, that's the piece that I think as we, you know, move, we've more, especially this year, it's very clear to me. I mean, we're a lifestyle company that's helping consumers get healthy. We are not we started out as a beverage company, but that's not what my goal was. That's never been my mission. It's really been to, you know, not only do something that's going to help me and my family get healthier, but also help other consumers really understand what the problems are that are pretty fast to resolve.
But is that hard though? And what I mean by asking that question is that, you know, you started off as a beverage company, and in fact, you're in one of the fastest growing segments of the beverage industry, right? Like, that's a pretty competitive space. So how are you able to then reposition the perception of your customers that you're not a beverage company, but you're a lifestyle company?
By just creating great products.
So do you have a long-term plan of adding more verticals to what you do?
Yeah, we could. I mean, I don't think we're coming out with another one shortly that I think will be very surprising to many. And it's and, you know, I think it'll be one that people say, why didn't I think of that? I mean, that's sort of our, you know, that our scratch test is, right? Would people say, oh, why didn't I think of that? Right? Like, that's a great product. And ultimately, that's a great company that's just trying to solve problems for the consumers, that they're like, of course I always wanted that product, right? And I think, you know, people say like, oh, what's the sunscreen called? And I say Hint, and they're like, oh, okay. Like, it's not, you know, it's not like we had to create an entirely different name, but it really, like, the more products we launch, the more it's clear to consumers that that's what our purpose is.
But yeah, I was going to say, are you concerned about confusing consumers?
Not at all.
No.
And also, I mean, you know, you talked about the family too. I mean, as my kids grow up and, you know, it's like my son who's 15 plays a ton of tennis and he's constantly putting sunscreen on. I mean, we have tons of, you know, advocates now for the sunscreen because of my kids. I mean, they constantly have water. They constantly have sunscreen. I mean, what more do you need, right? He's like, you know, it's like, oh, just go grab it out of their backpack, right? And, you know, so.
You make them pay for it, right? I'm kidding.
Sometimes. So, but, you know, it's funny, too, because we have internships throughout the country. And, you know, I always tell people, like, you know, I tell parents, like, don't write to me. I mean, it's fine that you wrote to me this once, but at the end of the day, like, your kids actually need to write to me and tell me what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Right. And so I teach lots of lessons along the way. And, you know, I think that's what this company is too, that we help solve problems for health, but then we're also looking for, you know, ways to actually help people think about things and not be caught in that same, you know, bad place that I found myself in, that was just believing that, you know, things like diet and low fat were healthy and better for me.
Yeah.
And instead, you know, you can create a better world by creating products that, that are, you know, truly good for you, and not, you don't have to have it be a nonprofit either.
So, last question 1A. So are you guys global as well, or expanding globally?
We have not gone outside of the US.
Okay.
Not to say that we haven't had interest, but we, my sort of personal goal is to create the product as close to our distribution points as possible.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And not ship water and, you know, other products overseas. So we'll definitely do that, but we're holding off on, mm-hmm. on really, you know, we've just been busy in the US. I mean,
yes.
The company's been taking off like crazy. So
it's a big market. So there's probably no rush at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Last question, Kara. Thank you so much for your time. So I ask this of everybody. And I think this is a really interesting question. And I like to get these answers that I get. And so the question is, for where you're at and what you're doing, how do you define happiness?
So I think happiness for me is really feeling like you have purpose and that you're, you know, I'm a big believer that I'm placed on this earth to connect something or someone together, right? Like that is the purpose, right? Mm-hmm. And so when people say like, oh, how did you decide to start a beverage company? Like I feel like years down the road, it will all be part of the master plan, mm-hmm. right? That it's just, you know, and the reason why, you know, I had, you know, I moved to New York and I now am able to connect, you know, I wouldn't have met my husband if I mm-hmm. wouldn't have moved to New York. I wouldn't, like, all of those things are like, I always find it really fun to be able to, you know, go back and look at those things. But I think it really boils down to if you can actually figure out happiness if you can figure out what your purpose is,
mm-hmm.
whether it's, you know, why you were there or, you know, what you were trying to solve. I think that that's the key thing for me.
Yeah,
so,
and I think, you know, just dovetailing a little bit, you know, your journey is yours and only you live that journey. And if you have the ability to be self-aware and self-reflective, you can see where each one of those stops added a piece to the Kara puzzle, to where Kara is
100%.
At now. And I think it's being able to appreciate that part of your journey that can actually add to your happiness of where you're at now, which is now driving your purpose for the next 20 or 30 years of your life, or 40 or 50, however long you're going to be alive for, you know, and that's a legacy that you leave not only with your family, but with your kids, and, you know, and the impact you have greater than that because of every stop you made, starting in Arizona as a child. Well, Kara, thank you for your time, energy, and willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
Thank you so much.
You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. Just believe it. Believe in it. You can do whatever you want.